It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the work of the Joint Legislative Council. Every 2 years, they create special study committees to dig deeper on certain issues when the legislature is out of session. An 11-member study group is examining barriers to employment and job training for people who are incarcerated and to recommend legislation. They held their second hearing Thursday, and we have two committee members. Join in, 800-642-1234. Ellie Rivera is co-founder and CEO of The Way Out, dedicated to employing formerly incarcerated people. He has a personal experience seeking employment after a felony conviction. Ellie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. We also have Sadiq Isahako, who is Dean of General Education Academic and Career Pathway at Milwaukee Area Technical College. He's also Administrator of Correctional Education Services. Sadiq, welcome to you.
Welcome. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
For inviting me.
Yes, so the latest testimony before this committee occurred Thursday, and I want to ask you both, what stood out to you? Sadiq, you first.
What stood out to me basically was the National Conference of State Legislatures report. They presented some research to us to tell us what is happening around the country.
What is happening around the country?
Well, about... what every state is doing to increase opportunities for formerly incarcerated individuals, as well as the opportunities to remove barriers to employment opportunities for them. For instance, ban the box.
And Ellie, you also picked up on this ban the box. Can you explain what's going on here?
Yeah, you know, as the doctor had mentioned, you know, there was a lot of great data and, you know, wonderful resources offered up and eye-opening things as well. The Ban the Box initiative really has been, you know, one to eliminate the bias of checking the box to say, yes, I've been convicted of a felony conviction. And so over time, that has really been integrated into the employment hiring process, where less and less states are allowing folks to even ask that question. But what was really interesting was, you know, in addition to the ban the box, were these studies on expungement and how expungement, another opportunity to level the playing field for formerly incarcerated individuals, has had a negative effect on hiring at large. So where ban the box has gone away and expungement has stepped in as a tool, it has created this gray area where some employers, unfortunately, are making assumptions now that some folks in front of them that may not have a conviction or otherwise experience incarceration may have. And although they don't see it on paper, maybe they should discriminate. And so we're seeing higher rates of discrimination against young Latino males and Black males as it comes to the hiring process.
When you see this bias and what the research is saying here, where do you fall? What do you think about having this box about having been convicted of a felony on applications?
Well, it's, you know, certainly mine and my partner's position that, you know, these biases are real and we need to get rid of them. And that's why The Way Out has created an anti-bias employment platform that removes a lot of these triggers from the hiring process, whether it's a name, a phone number, a zip code, or otherwise. So we stand very firmly that we know this is real, unfortunately, and we're doing everything we can to level the playing field and get folks put in the door.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about efforts to reduce people returning to incarceration after being released and expanding employment opportunities through committee work. You can join in at 800-642-1234, talking with Ellie Rivera from The Way Out, members of a legislative study committee examining this issue, and Sadiq Isahaku from MATC, Milwaukee Area Technical College. Sadiq, at least 9 improvement programs are available to people who are incarcerated in Wisconsin prisons. And the programs include information about domestic violence, about anger management, substance use disorder. What programs should corrections add to reduce offenders committing new crimes after release?
Yeah, these programs you mentioned are very important because some of them have been triggers that that make people end up in prison in the first place. However, it is also documented that the level of education and educational training for technical skills training are exceptionally important in reducing even the potential of going to prison. And in addition to that, after individuals are released, if they have a career or a job or training that will lead to a sustainable job, it goes a long way to preventing re-offense and conviction and imprisonment.
Some programs that corrections offers have wait lists into the thousands of people. What is causing the long wait times on these programs?
During our first session, the Department of Corrections did have a presentation, and I think the big take from that presentation was resources. They don't have enough resources to be able to provide classes and training for the treatment programs that you mentioned. In addition to that, they had about a 10,000 person wait list for career and technical education programs. And that part is something that the technical colleges through the WTCS system, there are 16 technical colleges in the state that could help the Department of Correction reduce the 10,000 wait list.
What is being done to reduce that wait list? Is there collaboration?
Absolutely. There is a lot of collaboration going on between DOC and the various technical colleges that are in the districts where you have prisons. For instance, we in Milwaukee Area Technical College collaborate very, very closely with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections to offer courses in 16 prisons across the state. We are fortunate to be one of the first institutions to be offered the Second Chance Pell program. So this allows us to provide free tuition to individuals who complete the financial aid application form, and then they would use that money to finance tuition and get into our programs to complete and get the credentials they need to find jobs. We, for instance, have every semester between 10 and 8 and 10 students come to our campus at the Workers Square location to get the welding fundamentals training and certification, which is an embedded certificate in the welding fundamentals technical diploma. And we have a very high job placement rate. Over 90% of the individuals who complete the program actually get hired before they are released.
I'd imagine in this economy that would be high. Ellie, when you hear a waiting list of 10,000 people for a career in technical college education, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, it's you know, unfortunate that these opportunities exist and they're not able to be access at the level that you know would certainly provide more opportunity to more people, and not just the education but the personal development side of things. They all work together in a job environment, so having that self-awareness that some of these you know anger management classes or other courses provide is critical. So once you're in the workplace, you're able to function at a higher level and work well with those around you. So it is very sad but understandable. You know, this environment of low employee pool is affecting everyone, including DOC.
Ellie Rivera there heads up the organization called The Way Out, and Sadiq Isahaku is Dean of General Education Academic and Career Pathway at Milwaukee Area Technical College. They're both part of a special legislative study committee examining how to improve job prospects for formerly incarcerated Wisconsinites, propose legislation in this area as well. Join in on gaining economic independence and stability. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the work of a Legislative Council study committee charged with identifying barriers to gainful employment and job training for people who are incarcerated or recently released. The State Department of Corrections published a report this year that showed 10-year highs for enrollment and completion rates in its treatment and education programs. But we also just heard about waiting lists that are in the thousands. Join in on job seekers with criminal records. 800-642-1234. We have Sadiq Isahaku, who's dean at Milwaukee Area Technical College and administrator of Correctional Education Services. Ellie Rivera is here, heads up the organization called The Way Out, and they are two of the 11 members of the study committee. They stay with us. Ellie, last year, the state health department reported 63% of inmates in our state had a substance use disorder. And if a person is released from prison with an untreated substance use disorder, how likely are they to reoffend?
Oh, unfortunately, very likely. It's really interesting that the employers that we speak with oftentimes set their bar in terms of who they would be willing to hire with a past offense. And they tend to kind of be biased towards folks potentially who have either a violent or sexual nature conviction for fear of disruption. And the truth of the matter, at least according to our data, has been that those with substance abuse tend to be the highest recidivating within our platform, certainly. So it is critical that folks come out and have already experienced, the work that needs to be done to help in this world where, unfortunately, substance abuse runs rampant, and these opportunities are everywhere for them to fall back into these behaviors. And so we see that as critical, both on the inside and continued support for substance abuse on the outside.
Ellie, as I was preparing to talk with you, some states I found are implementing individualized reentry plans that are specifically designed for the incarcerated individual based on their needs, based on their wants, their situation. How customized are Wisconsin's reentry plans, or how customizable, if you will, are Wisconsin's reentry plans?
Well, I hate to keep bringing up our platform, but our platform at The Way Out is designed just for that, to work with participating agencies to help identify and deliver these supportive services for individuals. It's really important that we recognize that it's not one size fits all for folks returning. Some folks may have a stable home to come back to, but need healthcare or other supportive services. And so really customizing that experience is the best way to assure success for these returning citizens once they're ready to return back to the real world.
Sadiq, you heard from workforce development leaders on Thursday in Milwaukee and South Central Wisconsin. What did they want to impress upon the committee?
The various programs that they offer to returning citizens, and We work very closely with Employ Milwaukee. We have developed certain relationships where the WIO partners send us referrals of individuals who have returned to their service areas. We also work together very closely to provide education and training at the Milwaukee House of Corrections, where we partner with Workforce Development Body Employ Milwaukee to provide GED, HSCD programs, as well as integrated education and training programs that offer individuals some technical trainings, so when they're released, they're able to use those skills to seek jobs.
Sadiq Isahaku with us from Milwaukee Area Technical College, a dean there. Ellie Rivera from The Way Out, both members of a legislative study committee examining the issues of reoffending and expanding job opportunities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Sherry is with us from WASA. Sherry, what's on your mind?
Good morning. My name is Sherry, and I am from the WASA area. I would say we don't want to forget about the ERP programs, the early release programs that a lot of the institutions' facilities do have. They use the CSEP program where the people that are incarcerated do find jobs before they are released. But one of my biggest concerns, and I work with this population, is when people that are incarcerated are released, they have nowhere to go. There are transitional living places, TLP houses. Many of the people that are incarcerated do not want to go there as they can be triggers. So the biggest thing, and I know a lot of people that are released as homeless. Hmm. So and that's the part that I find has been really difficult for people that have been incarcerated.
Sherry, thank you so much. Housing there, and I want a missing piece. I want both of you to respond. Ellie, you first.
Yeah, Sherry, you bring up a wonderful point there. You know, CSEP is an excellent program, and absolutely, housing is one of the highest needs for folks returning. And you're right. Personally, I can understand after being around people nonstop that you have no choice while incarcerated. The last thing you want to do is enter into a housing situation, although it may be necessary with other folks in these TLPs. We are working with, certainly over here in Milwaukee, with a network of landlords to help place some of these returning citizens, and really to help change the narrative about what type of tenants they can be. That's really the greatest opportunity, is just making sure that folks are good tenants when we get them placed in housing. But it is a challenge, and you're absolutely right. It can be a make or break situation.
Sadiq, what's coming up for you as you hear what Sherry brings to the table?
Yeah, Sherry, thanks for mentioning the ERP program. It's very important. One of the things that I am going to probably advocate for is a similar end release program that is specific to education and technical, I mean, it's career and technical education programs. When individuals finish certain career technical education programs, that they should get some credits towards their release. With regards to housing, if well coordinated, for instance, students who are in career technical education programs while and their release before completion, they can transition to Milwaukee Area Technical College to complete their programs. With regards to housing, we recently have been having conversations about the Westtown Green Housing Project that we have downtown, very close to campus. That eligible individuals who are released from incarceration could potentially, get housing at Westtown Green.
And we're going to have to leave it there and hopefully expand on Westtown Green. Sadiq Isahaku, Dean at Madison Area Technical College. Ellie Rivera heads up The Way Out. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are studying study committees, if you will. The Joint Legislative Council is a 22-member committee made up of both Republican and Democratic state lawmakers. And earlier this year, they formed six special legislative study committees to examine certain issues in depth during this interim period when the legislature is out of session. One of the study committees focused on shared school district services, and they held two meetings over the summer. Join in on sharing services between school districts, 800-642-1234. Lance Bagstad is superintendent of the School District of Arcadia and a member of the study committee. Superintendent Bagstad, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. You were scrambling in August to secure staff and teacher positions. And now that the school year is well underway, how are you doing with vacancies?
We're actually in a pretty good spot right now. We've been able to fill one of the vacancies that we did have in August. We still are using a couple of long-term subs, and we'll continue looking to fill those positions, hopefully with graduates at the semester from universities, or perhaps somebody that has decided to go back into the teaching profession will join us. But otherwise, we're in pretty good shape.
So for rural school districts, what are the services that schools and districts are having the hardest time providing?
Well, a lot of them I would just call our high need areas. We tend to have a difficult time with areas like science and math. A lot of our elective areas, especially in the areas of technology education, family and consumer science, world languages. But what's changed on the landscape of available staff across the state of Wisconsin in recent years is we used to see an abundance of individuals applying for elementary teaching positions. And that's even started to become a smaller and smaller pool of candidates that are applying for positions. And you know, if you touch base with any universities around the state of Wisconsin right now, they're having a difficult time as well, making sure their programs are filled and the seats are filled for those prospective future teachers.
The pipeline isn't as robust as what I'm hearing as it has been in the past.
Yeah, that would be accurate. You know, if you look back 15, 20 years ago, it was not unusual to get, you know, certainly high double digit and even triple digit applicants for some positions, as I mentioned, like elementary. Now we're hoping to get double digit applicants in most cases.
Let's talk a bit more about sharing services. What are the services that school districts realistically could most easily share?
Well, certainly that's one of the things that the Legislative Council on Shared School Services is looking at. And there could be a number of different areas that school districts could share services. Some of that really does depend on location. As you can imagine, in parts of northern Wisconsin, where there's many, many, many miles between school districts, sometimes sharing services becomes more difficult, especially if it's a teaching position. One of the things we've done here in West Central Wisconsin is we have four schools that have formed what's called the Trempealeau Valley Co-op 2.0. And what we've talked about is how in certain situations we may need to share a teacher, for example, in a world language might take place. And so we've talked about how that could work. There are other areas that certainly, services might be able to be shared, but it's not quite as easy as just saying, okay, we're going to share position A or position B because of sometimes the logistics that come into it.
Logistics like, I mean, considering your district is over 200 square miles. So if you mm-hmm. want to share a teacher with a neighboring district, that, I mean, you can't just realistically say, teacher, drive, 100 miles each way to teach.
Right. And the fortunate part is we've got three neighboring districts, four including ourselves, that are all within about 25 miles of each other at maximum. So if we were going to look at sharing a teacher, we would likely have to have that person working part of a day in one of the schools and part of a day in another one of the schools. So that's really what we would end up having to look at. And we know that it's not as simple as saying, hey, we're going to hire you and then we're going to have you go teach over in Whitehall or drive to Independence or drive to Blair Taylor. So we've looked at within our co-op ways to offset some of those costs with some mileage reimbursement if we get into that, some incentive dollars in the form of stipend dollars for a teacher that might be willing to travel. But then the other thing, and this is probably what came out of the pandemic over the last several years, is updated technologies that we can use to teach remotely. Now, there's some classes that teaching remotely is very difficult. You're not going to probably teach a small engines class or an auto repair class remotely, but you might be able to do a Spanish class, for example, or perhaps a math class. So looking at a variety of different ways of making that happen.
The remote delivery aside, have teachers taken you up on the incentive? Are they willing to travel?
Excuse me. We have not had anybody from Arcadia that has done that. And in part because we did not have really any available time in our teacher schedules to do that. But they are sharing some teacher services between a couple of our other districts, either through remote or travel. And I believe, if I remember correctly, it's travel between those two districts, or I'm sorry, remote instruction in those districts right now in the areas of English and Spanish.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about ways that school districts can share services, save money. Lance Bagstad, superintendent of the Arcadia School District and member of the Legislature Study Committee on this issue. You can join in on sharing school district services, on consolidation, what it could mean to your district. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Lance, sitting on this legislative study committee, what have you heard from other school districts about these problems that they're facing? Are they pretty universal when it comes to the issues and challenges of sharing services, making it a reality?
Well, so some of the testimony that we've had an opportunity to hear as part of the Council on Shared School Services has been from individuals that have either been in or are currently in positions where they are a shared pupil services director, for example, between two districts. We heard at our last meeting in August from a couple of North Central Wisconsin districts that explored sharing services and got to the point where they were talking, do they merge as one district? And they found that there really wasn't any cost savings that could be found by the time you start to increase busing distance, increase time on buses. And I think one of the things that might get forgotten from time to time is how important the school district and the school buildings are to especially small rural communities. They're often the central hub. They're where people it's the place where people gather for their kids, grandkids, neighbors, sporting events. And oftentimes, I think communities fear the consolidation piece of it because of that lost identity. And I guess one of the things I want to highlight is, the title of the committee itself is on school shared services. And I think one of the things that we need to make sure if we're exploring these ideas is how districts are going to remain fiscally viable through various opportunities with state funding in order to share some of these services. Because as I said, as I highlighted with shared teaching staff, it's actually not a savings to a full degree because we have had to find ways to attach a little bit more money to it with travel incentives and or an incentive for a person taking on that extra responsibility.
I want to just spend a little bit more time on losing identities, because you expressed this to the committee as well, that some small school communities, they feel like they lose their identities if they would combine or share services. What do you see there? And can you elaborate on that feeling?
Well, I think what sometimes can happen is a community all of a sudden joins another school district, and they no longer have that central hub of a school. Their kids are now perhaps traveling to a neighboring district to attend school. They don't have the home sporting events anymore. They don't have that central gathering place. And, you know, a lot of small communities identify by whatever happens to be their school nickname. They're known as the whatever they're known as with their mascots. So I think part of that really boils down to a feeling that we've had a school district for ever, and now all of a sudden we don't have one and we've lost that central hub.
You mentioned the additional busing issues, busing costs. What about, you know, other things like tax levies and mill rates, and then what to do with mothballing buildings? What are some issues that we might not be seeing here that would come up with consolidation?
Well, I think you just highlighted a few of them. It's how that mill rate is going to impact the districts that would be coming together as one. Could see an increase in a mill rate for districts. The other piece that comes along with that is referendum debt that comes along with that. If one neighboring district has either capital or operational referendum debt capital debt, mm-hmm. or some other type of debt that they're dealing with, suddenly the taxpayers in all of those communities now take on that mill or that tax levy and that consolidated referendum debt. So I think there's a lot of those pieces that do come into play.
Lance Bagstad, superintendent of the school district of Arcadia. A district, as I said earlier, spans about 200 square miles in two western Wisconsin counties, Buffalo and Trempealeau. Join in on shared resources and school consolidation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we check in on Legislative Study Committee work that's focused on shared school district services. The 10-member study group is reviewing barriers and exploring statutory changes or ways to incentivize district efficiencies. And the committee is also considering methods for sharing or consolidating services. Join in on ways school districts could combine or not, 800-642-1234. District of Arcadia Superintendent Lance Bagstad is on the study committee, stays with us. Let's bring on a call. Mark is here from Ashland. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I'm sitting here listening to this, and I'm a retired administrator, and one of the things that strikes me is administrators seldom want to talk about anything about saving money when it comes to administration. I would imagine you have four school districts there, each of which has a district administrator and a number of principals for buildings. One of the ways that these districts could save money, and while I think supervision of teachers is important, they don't need four district administrators that are costing districts $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. A district administrator could easily service two, three, maybe even four if he's a good time manager. So that's one of the things that could be considered. And that allows districts to maintain their identity.
Mark, thank you for that. Superintendent Bagstad, go ahead.
Yeah, I certainly think there are ways that you can look at those types of things. As he mentioned, part of it becomes, especially if you're looking at principals, as he mentioned. Having principals shared across buildings sometimes can become difficult, especially if there's a great distance between school buildings, especially if there's some need that's fairly immediate. Now, are there ways that that can be handled differently with, you know, perhaps deans of students or things like that? Certainly, that's a possibility. And as far as superintendents go, you know, there are, we do have a member of the Shared Services Committee that was a shared superintendent between two northern districts. I don't want to speak for him, but he's kind of shared some information about some of the difficulties that came into play at those, came into play as a shared superintendent between districts in terms of, for example, one piece that he did share was whether or not a district felt like the district administrator was giving them enough time, was giving them enough, I guess time is really what it boiled down to, is how much time the person was spending in each district to make sure that they felt like they were getting the services they needed as well.
Yes, I mean, I can understand, you know, you want it to be very equal in terms of what you can give. And then, you know, the other district might say, well, you know, they might not see it that way. So there, I would imagine, would be a little bit of a tug of war there.
Yeah, and certainly that's a bit of what he has shared in not his, really his testimony, because he's part of the committee, but what he shared as part of the committee is that back and forth, making sure that he felt like he was giving enough time to both districts.
Let's go to Dan in Green Bay with thoughts. Dan, what would you like to bring up?
Yeah, good morning. So I've been on both sides of the table. I was a teacher. I was an administrator when I was working abroad, and I came back, and I was really surprised. I worked at a school that had 450 students, and there was a superintendent each school, as well as a principal, a vice principal, and it seems to me Wisconsin school systems are real top-heavy administratively, and I never really understood how a super, like, why they need so much administration in a school that has 450 kids.
Dan, thank you. Superintendent Bagstad.
Yeah, and I would say in our area in Western Wisconsin, that's not necessarily the case. There are superintendents that also serve as a either elementary principal or a high school principal, or serve in some other roles. So, you know, I think smaller districts like that are operating in that way. But, you know, for example, in other smaller districts too, I think there's a lot of behind the scenes things that individuals don't see, that superintendents oftentimes in small districts are also the business manager. They're dealing with HR pieces. So there's a lot more behind the scenes that sometimes happens that, especially in districts, you know, our size of 1300, you know, I'm technically serving as the business manager as well. So, you know, there's a lot of pieces that come into play there, but there are districts all over the state of Wisconsin that have small student populations where the superintendent is either the K-12 principal or a principal at either an elementary or a high school level.
Hmm. Lance Bagstad with us, superintendent of the Arcadia School District, member of the Legislature Study Committee on the issue of shared services. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's turn to open enrollment. Wisconsin schools having an open enrollment system that allows kids to attend a school in a district other than where their family lives, and schools get additional state funds when children from other districts enroll. How much do district officials take those revenue streams into account when looking at shared services?
Well, I think certainly it can have an impact. I mean, obviously there are school districts that that have a plus, excuse me, on the open enrollment side, and there are districts that have, you know, a minus. They've got more kids leaving than coming in. Certainly that can have an impact. Excuse me. So if you were to look at the number of kids that are going between schools, you know, at a share over $8,000 per student, sharing services, sometimes you could say, well, open enrollment could be a disincentive to sharing services, because if a student moves from a neighboring district to, for example, our district, it's a financial gain for us, where our co-op that we're working in right now, we do not necessarily have a large number of students who actually truly open enroll between our districts, because they have opportunities to take classes in the other three districts that they're not necessarily a resident district of. And we operate that through a joint powers agreement that was agreed upon by all four school boards. So rather than pursuing kids through open enrollment, we're looking at internally, how do we continue to offer more opportunities for kids by working together on those things?
Do you create more of a competition, a competitive situation for getting students? And maybe that spirit of cooperation between districts falls away when you look at the dollars that are attached to the student.
I would say it certainly does. When you are competing for kids because of the dollars that are attached, I think it does to some degree disincentivize districts from cooperating with their neighbors. Now, that's not always necessarily true. I mean, there are a lot of districts that already are trying to cooperate and work together with sharing staff members or sharing services between the two. I mentioned earlier, one of the individuals that gave testimony had been a shared pupil services person between districts. I mentioned the former superintendent who's on the committee right now. And so there are districts doing that. We're doing it in our four school co-op here in West Central Wisconsin.
We only have a few seconds left. What is the future of the study committee? Will you meet again?
Yeah, there's one more meeting planned in October for sure. Beyond that, we're not sure if it will meet again, but we shared some ideas at the last meeting about potential thoughts about legislation that either could be modified or introduced. And I do know that the attorneys for the Ledge Council have been working on some of that. So I'm fairly confident that at the October meeting, actually October 26th, I believe, that we'll be talking about some of those types of things.
Superintendent Bagstad, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Appreciate the time.
Lance Bagstad is superintendent of the Arcadia School District in Western Wisconsin, a member of the Legislative Council Study Committee on Shared School District Services. We have a link to the committee landing page at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we explore a range of challenges facing Wisconsin veterans. We start with a UW-Milwaukee faculty member examining this issue. Join in 800-642-1234. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.